This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guests this week are Matt Johnson and Prince Gooman.
Brands are at a bit of a crossroads right now, and allow me to explain. I think you could have gotten away with mediocre branding until platforms came in. Unless your brand on a scale of 1 to 10 is 8.9 or higher, I would say you're an endangered species.
Prince is the co-author of the definitive neuromarketing book, Blindsight, CEO and founder of the neuromarketing certification at Pop Neuro, and professor at Holt International Business School. Previously, he held dual roles as the U.S. Director of Consumer Marketing and the Global Director of B2B Marketing for OFX, a publicly traded fintech company handling over $100 billion in international payments. A contributor to major news outlets including Forbes, Refinery29, Entrepreneur, and The Washington Post, he was named as one of the movers and shakers by the San Francisco Chronicle. Matt Johnson is the co-author of Blindsight, a professor and researcher at Holt International Business School. He received his BA in psychology from UC San Diego and his PhD in cognitive psychology from Princeton University, where his dissertation focused on the neural basis of language and communication. His research focus now is ultimately about bridging the gap between neuroscience and marketing, and to this end, works across several fields, including experiential marketing, behavioral economics, and marketing ethics. Prince, Matt, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks so much, Nick, for having us, Nick.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Nick.
Well, I am excited to have you both here, and I have to say I feel smarter after having just read your two bios. So we're off to the races already.
Oh man. Well, I'm glad to be of service. It's kind of, you know, it's always a little strange to hear your bios, but we did all those things, believe it or not. In what feels like 15 short years.
So talk a little bit, because it's not every day that we have two guests on the podcast, and that seems like a logical place to start. Talk about where your partnership came from. Obviously, there's some work experience at Holt there, but mm-hmm. what led you to deepen that relationship even further?
Yeah, so I'll kick things off. So as mentioned, the bio, my background is in neuroscience. I'm really fundamentally driven by a curiosity about why we do the things we do. I think humans are endlessly fascinating, paradoxical, strange, unpredictable creatures. And there's no shortage of experiments which can be conducted to really probe further into human nature. I think the technologies and the methodologies at our disposal in neuroscience are able to allow us to go even further here. So I think really studying the brain and how the brain gives rise to all of our mental processes is really the most fruitful way of understanding human nature. So that's really what I did for most of my mid-20s. Spent my mid-20s in my PhD program really in labs and libraries. and didn't really think so much about the application of some of these ideas. I really just wanted to dive into the minutiae, dive into the nuances. And when I graduated for my PhD, there's sort of this ceremonial process you get to do where you have your big bounded PhD thesis, about 150 very dense pages of experiments and ideas that you've produced. And what you do is you go to this very particular part of the library, and you get to sort of ceremoniously put this into the library. And when I did that, I also put a $20 bill in it, because I was convinced at the time that nobody would ever read this. And I guarantee if you went to that corner of the library today, you'd probably still find that crisp $20 bill still there. So for me, that was really just the sort of the distillation of sort of the academic perspective. I sort of found my complete inverse in the form of Prince Guman when we reconnected after I finished my PhD, and Prince was on his entrepreneurial journey, and this sort of led us into discussions about how our two fields can be connected. Prince, you want to tell us a bit about your background and how we rekindled?
Yeah. So, you know, in the parallel path, we'll Tarantino this going backwards before we
like
before
it.
We sort of before we joined forces at HALT. While Matt was at Princeton working on his PhD, I had spent about a decade reading abstracts and reading pop neuroscience and pop psych books and as many abstracts as I could, and then apply them to marketing. And for the first half of my career, I worked at startups of different size, from a startup of less than five people to one that scaled up to about 250. And that was just sort of right place, right time for me, because I got to not only read these abstracts and this bit of research, but also test it immediately with less red tape getting in the way. So after doing that for about a decade, I was found myself in San Francisco at OFX doing all of those things you mentioned in the bio. And that's when I connected with Matt. And it was a, you know, peanut butter and jelly or salt and pepper moment where I've been reading the bullet point version of work that neuroscientists like Matt do and applying it, whereas Matt had been doing all the underpinning and the research and the understanding of human behavior and kind of searching for how to apply this damn thing. So, I mean, ultimately what Matt calls human behavior is what I called consumer behavior. And that's how we met at HALT. And that led to creating a neuromarketing course that didn't really exist, and we couldn't find a textbook for it. So we started to write one together, and that's where Blindsight came in. And it's not really written as a textbook in the traditional sense. We wanted it to be approachable for the layperson who's not a student or a practitioner, but nonetheless, it sort of breaks down what we consider to be the main features of neuromarketing.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because you talked about some of the pop neuroscience out there, and I'd say a lot of us in marketing today know enough to be dangerous, and when it comes to brain science, consumer behavior, human behavior, everything you just mentioned. What's an important distinction to make when you're talking to a marketer out there in a pre-pandemic environment over cocktails, and someone said, "Yeah, I read an article once about this." what's the important distinction between the real thing and everything else?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'll start, Matt, and you can jump in whenever you'd like. I think the first thing, a lot of these articles that have history and SEO algorithms love them, they all talk about the buy button. So one of the first things that we get when we're coaching this stuff to CMOs or grad students is, oh, is this like mind control or some form of that question about a buy button? and Matt and I, you know, it's not often we roll our eyes, but we roll our eyes consistently when this question comes up. So any marketers listening who are super curious about psychology and neuroscience, I hate to break it to you, there is no buy button, right? The brain isn't quite that simple. So that's the first thing I'd like to say. I do think that certain aspects of behavior economics specifically have been popularized over the years, and definitely Matt and I nerd out on that quite a bit. And for me, in my personal journey to understanding neuroscience and now researching neuroscience and applying it, behavior science was a gateway drug. Behavior economics was a gateway drug. Daniel Kahneman, right? So the thinking fast and slow, I would say, is probably the most popular application of this world. But man, that's just decision making. That's the beginning. So Matt, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say as well that I think when people sort of come across little bits or this interesting, you know, study or anecdote, if that's sort of the one thing they come in with, they come with a pretty sort of superficial understanding of human behavior, which they wouldn't even like to be reflected of themselves. So, for example, people will come in and say, oh, I read an article about, you know, the color blue and color psychology, and let's just make our, you know, our homepage blue, and that'll make, you know, our customers do X. And, you know, if you were to say to the person, well, you know, blue makes you do X, but no, I'm a complex individual, you know, I'm not compelled by the color blue. And yet that's the idea that they would get, you know, having just read something, you know, in an article or sort of having a passive understanding. So really, I think, you know, the value of really coming with a disciplined understanding is, it's much more complex, it's much more nuanced, and it's much more context dependent, which I think is crucial. So there's a lot of different biases, a lot of different heuristics, there's a lot of different psychological phenomena, but humans are complex, and we operate in certain contexts in certain ways which just simply don't generalize to any others. And so I think we have to sort of treat humans as the complex entities that they are, and this requires going above sort of the little tidbits that are compiled and chalked together over time.
So I think those are great concerns to raise. So flip it around the other way. If we know what to worry about, where do you start with your brand and human behavior?
Oh, well, I think I love this question. I think we can talk about what the answer would have been a few years ago, but we should talk about what the answer is now and what it will be for the foreseeable future. And I think brands are at a bit of a crossroads right now. And allow me to explain. I think you could have gotten away with mediocre branding until platforms came in, until Amazon became what Amazon is, right? So until, you know, everyone is a bookstore, if you want me to use that analogy, and Amazon is coming. And so when it comes to just having a sort of call to action for marketing and branding teams everywhere, unless your brand on a scale of 1 to 10 is 8.9 or higher, I would say you're an endangered species. And it's because of the commodification of product by Amazon that we are here now. Matt, you want to jump in?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think we understand pretty well what good branding looks like and what people describe when they feel like the brand is a part of them. And there's really an endearment there that goes above and beyond the raw utility of the product that they offer. And they do feel a strong sense of social identity. And a sense of connection there. And there's actually community within people that also are followers of that brand. And so I think we do know what branding looks like when it succeeds. And as Prince is mentioning, that the bar is set so high now. So it's Lululemon level cult brand personality or bust. So if people are not sort of looking out for the brand and their products in a very special way, if the brand doesn't generate that much demand, it's swallowed up by the platform, because there's going to be a company that's going to do it faster, better, cheaper. And if the brand and their products doesn't go above and beyond, then it just doesn't cut mustard. And so I do think that the branding really has never been more important because of the effects of platforms now.
Hey, On Brand listeners. We talk about a lot of brand building topics here on the show, from developing strong brands to brand stories to building engaged superfans for your brand, both internally and externally. If these are topics that you're working through or struggling with, I'd love to help. I regularly schedule one-time or ongoing brand coaching sessions with clients based on their unique needs. Are you building a new brand? I'd love to help. Struggling with rebranding? I'd love to help. Do you want to create an engaged community around your brand? I'd love to... You get the idea. I've worked with clients of all shapes and sizes, from Fortune 500 companies to small businesses and startups. I've also interviewed hundreds of experts right here on the On Brand podcast and written 2 books. I can apply all of this to the challenges that you're struggling with. To learn more about working personally with me, Nick Westergaard, go to nickwestergaard.com, that's Westergaard with 2 A's, or email me at nick@branddrivendigital.com. Now back to the show.
So with the, I love that concept of the, I mean, because I would think that's an extension of the more savvy consumer that, that we have, and we're seeing this, we're exposed to this because of platform proliferation, the commoditization of good branding, as you both just mentioned. So it used to be, and I think that's an important distinction to make, it used to be, okay, I can come in with anything else, but if I really want to take it to the next level, that's where I sprinkle some of this good branding thing on there. I mean, I think of the, you know, airlines that by and large are awful brands, then someone could come along and be JetBlue and say, yeah, we're going to do the other stuff, but we're going to have be a good brand that stands for something and has some different service wrapped around that. Whereas today you're saying that now that former point of entry is sort of table stakes, yes?
Yes, I think JetBlue, if they were to launch today, let's create an imaginary scenario. Let's say JetBlue launches today and so does Virgin America, okay? By the way, Nick, I 100% agree with you. I think airlines are lazy branders, and I don't know why. And I realize that they have very, you know, like revenue per seat, and oil prices are in flux. So sometimes they're working on really thin margins. Sometimes they hedge for oil prices. Like Southwest over the last 10 years, pre-COVID, made a ton of money because they hedged forward on oil prices, and that set them up. And obviously the product was great, and et cetera, et cetera. So, but I digress. Let's talk about Virgin America, right? So Virgin America launched in the U.S. Virgin Atlantic had been around for quite a while. And at a time where it was absolutely crazy to launch an airline in the U.S. And it still is crazy to launch an airline in the U.S. And not only did they launch it, but they were very selective about which cities, right? New York, Chicago, San Diego, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami, right? All these young, hip cities. They marketed to that target demographic really well. So far, so good. This is very, you know, marketing 101. However, they created an experience that was above and beyond. They created an experience that Matt and I would say is 8.9 or higher on a 1 to 10 scale. And that is why not only did they succeed, but they got an exit within the first decade of launching in the U.S. So, you know, swimming upstream is one thing, and swimming upstream and having an exit in a decade is unheard of. And if you really think about what Virgin was able to do in the States, no other airline was branding an experience quite like this. We're talking lighting, very specific hues of color, very specific beats per minute onboarding and offboarding music. And they actually had a chat box per seat. Right. So we're talking an experience that is thought through and through. So if you're looking at a $50 flight from San Diego to Las Vegas and your options are JetBlue, Southwest, and Virgin, one of those is heavily differentiated as an experience and in turn as a brand. And that's what you have to be now. You have to be Virgin America or better. You cannot be in middle. So to go back to what you said, Nick, you know, I posit that you can't just sprinkle a little bit of brand anymore, right? And the three of us are old enough to remember when GMC had like 3,500 brands, right? It was an Oldsmobile rebadged as a Buick, rebadged as even a Saab, right? It was the exact same vehicle. And up until the 80s, they didn't even bother to change the design. They just changed the badge, right? That is my example of sprinkling a little bit of branding magic. It's not going to work anymore.
So Is there, in an attempt to connect some of the dots, if this brand, if branding is essential, as you just made in that case, and not just being able to sprinkle or badge or any other quick and dirty verb there, is there a hooks in the brain science, in human behavior today, that we can, I say hooks because are there things that we can grab onto to help us create a stronger brand at this time when it's more essential than ever?
Absolutely. Matt, jump in, but I'll outline it and you jump in whenever you'd like. Absolutely, yep. Nick. I think we cover this in the book. We have 12 chapters and each one talks about a different neuroscientific principle. The only one that got two chapters was memory. And I think if your brand isn't memorable, then did it really happen, right? It's kind of like the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, but for branding. So I think understanding the neuroscience of memory is step one. And I think the second piece we miss out on quite a bit is empathy and how to re-engineer empathy and the human connection authentically at brand level and scale that.
Yeah, so I think really when it comes to memory, there's a couple things that are really important for branding in particular. So we have this one word, memory, and there's actually quite a few subcomponents of it at the level of the brain. And I think really when we're talking about branding, we're talking about semantic memory. We're talking about our experience that's converted to our understanding of the world. And we actually do know through neuroimaging studies now that brands exist within the architecture and the synaptic connections in the temporal lobe. And you can actually see where certain brands are. They've done experiments, for example, and you can see effectively where Coca-Cola is at the level of the brain. And you can see sort of how this relates to different associations which are built over time. So Coke, for example, spending, you know, $10 billion plus every single year associating the Coke brand with happiness. So Coke happiness, Coke happiness, Coke happiness, to the point where you can't think about Coke without thinking about happiness, and you can hardly think about happiness without thinking about Coca-Cola. And as a differentiator, that's crucial, right? So then what do you do if you're a competitor? You can't, you know, associate yourself with happiness. You have to do something different. So Pepsi, you know, tries to associate themselves as, you know, the hip, cool, funky brand. You know, we're not the happiness wholesome brand, but we're the with the times brand. So you have to differentiate. You're sort of forced into that corner. And this is something that brand strategists, I think, know intuitively, but is also deepened with an understanding of neuroscience as well.
So I love what you said about where brands exist in the brain and the connections of meaning. And I wanted to get real topical because I feel like I've seen some pieces on this recently. As we find ourselves in this pandemic of the brands that people are turning to, are those ones that do mean something to us, that I feel like it's almost the, if you've got comfort food, the comfort equivalent of brands, are there differences in how our brains are responding to brands here in this pandemic?
I'll take this one first, Prince. Then you can hop in. So yeah, so I do think so. I do think that that's not just something that we're noticing sort of anecdotally. So we know, for example, in social neuroscience that we have our social cognition is attuned to people. That's sort of the underlying way in which we see the world. So you know your car isn't human, but you still describe your car with human-like traits. And it's you know, it's a little bit slow to start up in the morning, and you sort of coax it, and you rub the hood, and you're like, oh, come on, even though you know clearly it doesn't have any, you know, sentience to it. And the same is with brands. So we tend to personify brands the same way in which we see people, we also see brands. And so with that sort of framework in mind, we can look deeper into social psychology and we can see, well, if we see people the same way we see brands, is it the case that the things that we appreciate about people, we also appreciate in brands? And it turns out that there's a lot of evidence To this effect. And this is known as the warmth competence model. This is pioneered by Dr. Susan Fiske, who's also a professor of mine at Princeton, which has really indicated that these two dimensions, warmth and competence, this is what we assess almost instantaneously when we see somebody. So within the first something like 6 seconds, when you meet somebody for the first time, you're assessing them on dimensions of warmth and competence. So warmth being, do they have good intentions? Do they have worthy intentions? And competence, do they actually have the ability to act out these intentions? And in studies of looking at the warmth competence model with brands, we see that the most beloved brands, sort of the Coca-Colas, the Campbell Soup, the Hershey's, these are all upper right. They're high warmth and high competence. And really, it's up to the brand to demonstrate their warmth. And when it comes to a demonstration of warmth, this is also reflected in social psychology. It comes down to really a demonstration of one's good intentions. So one's good intentions, their investment in the well-being of their consumers, really above and beyond any business interests. So one example that comes to mind there is Zappos. So I feel like you can talk about Zappos in so many different ways when it comes to excellent branding and excellent marketing. But they've done incredible things that had no business angle at all. So when there was a big storm, I think it was 2010 on the East Coast, their employees went out into their community and they knocked on doors and they made sure people were safe and they had enough warm clothes. And they just handed out free gloves and mittens and scarves. And Zappos doesn't sell any of these things. Zappos is a shoe company. And yet it was so endowed within the culture within Zappos that you just sort of look out for people and you express your good intentions really at every potential opportunity. And so brands that are beloved tend to be very high in warmth and competence. And warmth in particular has to do with sort of a demonstration of these good intentions.
And if I could add to that, I think part of this is the evolution of the consumer, Nick. I think, you know, we created the brand personality wheel and we picked a brand and we researched it in focus groups and surveys and then we executed on it. And then that helped us grow revenue, right? But now consumers are catching up to that and they're actually holding brands responsible for the personality they've chosen in branding 101, right? So you can't be a joker without actually doing real jokes. You can't be a hero brand anymore without actually doing heroic things. And I think that's where we are. And I think a lot of larger brands are struggling with this because what worked for the last 20 years is now showing its cracks, right? Because now you actually have to have, personifying a brand, when Matt said that, you have to own the personification and not just at the vanity personality type level, but at decision-making level. And yes, this makes people uncomfortable at the social level. And that's why you're seeing some of the brands take what feels like risks right now, right? When Nike came out and did the entire activation with Colin Kaepernick, people thought Nike was crazy. But now history is going to reflect on that as not crazy. Right? Because that's where branding is headed. Surface level personification isn't enough anymore. If a brand was a real person, what would your brand do during hard times such as X, Y, and Z? That's where we are and that's where we're headed.
You know, one of the sad byproducts of having two guests on the show at once is that the time flies by. But I actually have an amazing segue to help us wrap up here, because we've been talking about competence and warmth. So theoretically, as I ask each of you for a brand that has made you smile recently, I'm guessing they would score pretty highly in some combination thereof. I don't know if we want to do a jump ball on this, or who wants to start things off?
Matt, go for it.
All right. This brand, I think, would be pretty high on both warmth and competence. And this for me would be Starbucks. So I think we're sort of at a period now where there's been a bifurcation, and there's economic inequality, and shared consumer experiences are really hard to come by. So it used to be Andy Warhol, Coca-Cola, all Cokes are good Coke, everybody has a Coke. And that was sort of this era of the 1950s, 1960s, and we all had that sort of shared consumer experience. Now, you know, very literally, you know, nobody's drinking Coke anymore. It's sugary beverages are bad. But more generally, as there's been this bigger economic divide, there's fewer and fewer consumer experiences that we can all share. And I think Starbucks, being a brand that's pretty well distributed all over in the U.S., has the potential to be a brand that really brings people together of all walks of life. And I think it's really pretty rare now that we have a brand that can create these shared experiences. And I think Starbucks, hopefully, especially post-pandemic, will be a brand that can bring people together.
Oh, that's a good one. I've got to go with Red Wing. I think Red Wing shoes is very unique in a sense that it's made in America, and they not only make shoes, but they own their own tannery. So if you think about complete vertical integration from beginning to the end, they have it down. And made in America is, you know, I don't know what types of products long-term we can make in the U.S., but the fact that we are making quality product in the U.S., wakes up the patriot in me. But I also love the business model. They've been able to pull it off. And they aren't really using neuromarketing, but again, they're using intuition, where they unionize their workers and they support the union. And every time you open up a handmade shoe, there's literally the name of the union worker who made it. It says, "I checked this out completely." And on the tag of the actual shoe, it says verified by so-and-so, built on this date. That's it. And there's a lot of Minnesotans making Red Wing boots. And I really appreciate all the care that goes into Red Wing.
Well, those are awesome brands and made me smile just hearing about them. Matt Prince, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Thank you for that, Nick. We keep popneuro, popneuro.com. We've written a book, but we also teach neuromarketing to CMOs and marketing directors. And we have a boot camp, a 3-day boot camp. And you can find all the information at popneuro.com.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Prince, Matt, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you for having us, Nick.
Thanks so much for having us, Nick. It's been a pleasure.
And as a reminder, you can find those show notes, links, and more at onbrandpodcast.com. And remember, if you like what you're hearing, if we've made you smile, please subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. And please take a moment and rate and review the podcast to help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.